Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031.
And a very good evening to you. It must be evening, it's just after 6 o'clock. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Great to be here again. You can email Mooney at rte.ie and you can also send a text message to 51551, or if you're used to using WhatsApp, it's 087 708 7031 for all your questions, queries and wildlife observations. Let's say hello to the panel today. In the studio, I've got Niall Hatch. Hello, Niall. How are you today? All good?
Very good, Derek. Yeah, I'm doing well.
You got your first vaccine this afternoon.
I did. I got to queue up in the Shoreline Centre there in Greystones, and it was all very efficient and very smooth, and I didn't feel a thing.
Well, I'll let you know if you start turning purple or blue or any other colour that you shouldn't be, okay?
Thank you.
Good to have you. Aina Nealon is in County Clare. What kind of weather is in County Clare today, Aina?
Well, the weather is like textbook. It's like as if I've gone to another country, Derek. The sky is blue, the sea is blue, I've had a dip in the ocean, and I'm not blue myself. It was actually warm today for a change, and I stayed in for ages and ages. So it's really lovely, I have to say. Clare is super duper.
Clare is always super duper. Speaking of blue, later in the programme we'll be talking to Dr. Eiske Britton, who's co-author of a paper and a member of the Whittaker Institute in NUI Galway. This is ahead of World Oceans Day next Tuesday. And she's suggesting one of the things we can do to reconnect with nature and the oceans is for healthcare professionals to prescribe blue prescriptions, to write more blue prescriptions. Have you ever heard the like, Aina?
Well, I don't know what you mean by the word blue. Blue has various connotations. But I assume we mean, in this case, blue meaning the water. And a prescription would be to actually give somebody a prescription to tell them to go to the water's edge or to the sea because it would be good for their mental health. But, well, you know, certainly the people at Clare didn't need to be told that today. It was jammers. You couldn't get near Kilkee or Quilty or La Hinch or Liscannor. The whole place, if they were getting a prescription, I wouldn't shudder to think of many more people who would be there. People know when the sun shines, the sea is the place to be. I do like to be beside the seaside.
Richard Collins is in Malahide and he lives right beside the seaside. He can see it from his front window. Richard.
Hello, Derek. Yes, this is a very blue location as well. I think this is a very wise move to suggest that prescriptions be in colours, particular colours. Colours connect with feelings. The red is that of violence and aggression and bravery and all that sort of thing. The green is growth and trees and spring and all that. But the blue is serenity, infinity, the void. Peace. It is a special colour for that. It is the colour of mindfulness and all that sort of thing. I'm getting carried away, Derek. Look what you've done to me.
No, it's all good, Richard. It's all good. Now, you mentioned red there. We're going to talk about red now because the other day myself and Anna, my co-producer, were having a discussion about what should we have in the programme this Sunday. And just before we finished our meeting, Anna said this to me.
Derek, don't forget to talk to Niall. He wants to show you a picture.
And I said, OK, have you seen it?
I have. And as you'd say yourself, it's fantastic.
Not quite sure that's the way I say the word fantastic. But at any rate, I did exactly what Anna told me to do, which was speak with Niall.
Derek, I've taken a really interesting photograph of a robin. Would you like to see it?
And I said, sure. Where did you take it?
At the East Coast Nature Reserve in Newcastle, County Wicklow.
Wow, that's fantastic. Then I asked him what kind of lens did he use. What kind of lens did you use to get so close? Was it a medium or a super telephoto?
Neither, actually. I took this with my mobile phone. Can you believe it?
And then I said, it's hard to believe because you seem so close to the bird. But I thought I'd ask one more rather delicate question. Are you sure it's not a mountain owl? And he said...
No, it was very much alive and well. It was just a very tame robin that never even twitched its wing as I took its picture.
A very tame robin. This gave me an idea. So I headed down to Donnybrook and into my favourite coffee shop, Carpe Diem. The owner, Mo, said good morning.
Good morning, Derek. How are you?
I'm surviving. Then he asked me what type of coffee I wanted.
Did you decide about your coffee today?
I'm trying to give up caffeine.
Decaf? One calf? Or one shot? Okay. Well, I'm going to do for you one calf then.
I picked up my one calf, as Mo calls it, and a blueberry muffin. And from there, I headed into Herbert Park and just waited till a robin came along.
Ah, now. Come on, little fella. Come on. Just a little bit of my blueberry muffin.
Believe me, I tried to woo that robin, but I simply couldn't get it to land on my hand.
He's taking the crumbs all right and looking at me, tilting his head to the side so he can get a good clear view of me. The eyes are on the side of the head. Come on, come a bit closer. You're supposed to be the friendly bird. No, he's gone.
And he was gone. And I laughed. And I tittered, and I did all sorts of things, but gone he was. Now, Niall mentioned, as you heard there, that he got that close to take a picture because the bird was so tame. And I'm wondering, why is it that the robin is known as the friendly bird? Why is it the tamest? It gets free worms from following the farmer and the gardener when it's out in the field mowing the lawns or turning the turf or whatever it is. But why haven't other birds copped onto this? If it's benefiting, why don't other birds realise they could benefit also? That's my question. And why could I not get it to land on my hand? But go for the first question first, Niall.
Well, of course, robins are known for this. They're known for this tameness. You call it friendliness as well. But those are two separate things. It doesn't necessarily want to be our friend. It sees us as an easy meal ticket.
Like royalty.
Well, perhaps
they're
so.
Friendly, but they're not your friends.
Yeah, there's a distance there, absolutely. So we like to think that creatures like us and they want to make friends with us. But in fact, what the robins are doing is they're exploiting a food source. It's all about reducing competition. So I always say, in the same way that a song thrush reduces competition by being the only bird that will feed on snails, so the robin reduces competition from other birds by being one of the only birds really that will approach human beings for food. And other birds haven't really learned to do this. I wouldn't say the robin's the only bird that does this. Just today in Greystones, I was taking a walk down the beach getting my own blue prescription, and I saw there were quite a few people out there, and starlings were gathering around them, coming very, very close, almost looked like they would take food from people's hands. Sometimes you'll see it with gulls now as well. We've talked about that in the programme too, where gulls have sort of learned that some humans can give them food and they'll approach them too, whereas normally gulls would be frightened to approach us. So it's all about seizing opportunities. And to answer your question, some birds are better at exploiting opportunities than others. So a bird like a blackbird, they're very highly strung. They just won't approach humans that closely. But it seems that birds like starlings, robins, gulls, they can overcome that. Perhaps that's a sign of intelligence. They're able to exploit a new resource. They're weighing up the risks, because there's a risk when you approach a human, because a human is a potential predator, could do them harm. But they're thinking, that's outweighed by the fact that I could get an easy meal from this creature, and the risks are probably quite low. So they seem to do this cost-benefit analysis, to talk in corporate speak. And I think that's why it is. But we only see this sort of tame behaviour with robins really here in Ireland and across the water in Britain. On the continent, where it's a very common species, they're not known so much for that tameness. They're a bird of the forest, the edges of the gardens. They tend to avoid people. A common bird, people would know them and they would see them. They'd come to bird tables, but they won't tolerate such a close approach. And that's because in those countries, they have another option, a better option for them.
Which is?
The wild boar. They like to latch onto wild boar in forests, and that's the species that they follow around. The boar snuffles through the leaf litter, turning over the soil. Spiders run out. The robin grabs those. That's no competition to the boar. They don't care. The robin is no threat to them. So they leave it do its thing. But here in Ireland and in Britain, we lost our boar.
No, but we've got the gardener and the farmer. Are they a wild boar?
That's exactly what it is. It's the same sort of thing. They latched onto another creature that was turning over the soil, that was engaged in sort of digging up and maintaining the landscape. And they said, well, this is my easy meal ticket. And of course, when I say they said that, of course, this is instinct. This is something that came this way with them. And it seems that that's how this tameness and this reputation for friendliness came about. We see it a lot with birds and other creatures as well that are isolated on uninhabited islands. A lot of them have no fear of people because they haven't had to learn it. Mm. People haven't been a risk. So places like the Galapagos Islands, which were uninhabited for a long, long time, there's a population there now. But the wildlife there has found that, you know, they said that humans aren't really a problem at all. They don't seem threat from people. They haven't learned that fear. So what happens is people can approach them, or they'll approach the people, and that just hasn't evolved. And that can be a disaster, of course, for many birds when humans would hunt them. So they arrive on an island, they have no defence against humans. The dodo would be a perfect example of that. The extinct member of the pigeon family that was found in Mauritius. When the first sailors arrived there, they found this very large and what they thought very stupid bird, hence the name dodo that they gave it. They thought it seemed to have no fear of people at all because it had never met a predator before in its life. And of course, it was easy pickings for them. They didn't even need to use their guns. They could just pick them up. And then, of course, that helped to reduce their numbers and then introduce rats and so on, destroy their eggs. And the pigs, again, they had a problem with them, and that's why it went. So it's because they didn't need to evolve fear.
Richard?
Yes, that is very interesting. Every species must decide whether it's going to hitch its wagon to another species, a species which may be a rising star. In the case of the robin, hitching to us was a good choice in these islands. Now, all birds have to make that kind of decision. All creatures really have to make that decision. What are we going to do about this rising species, Homo sapiens, people? They're everywhere. They're into everything. Now we can join them or we can repudiate all connection with them. We see it very much in the swans, for instance. The whooper swan that comes here won't have anything to do with us. It shuns us. It's very shy. Whereas the mute said, well, hang on now. This lot, they might be exploitable. We could move into their cities. We could even nest in their ponds and places, canals, and they'll throw us bread and they'll do all kinds of things. So it works both ways, you see. But I think Niall mentioned the gull. This herring gull. The gulls seem to me the supreme fellows to adapt to us. Remember, we call them seagulls. They were sea scavengers, shore scavengers. Next, in the 19th century, they start following the plough because the plough turns up worms and leather jackets and all kinds of creepy crawlies. So, and then, if that wasn't enough, they go after the herring fleets. Fish, offal thrown overboard, and then the whale boats, all the offal that's thrown out of the whale boats. So they cash in on that. So this is their second great change. Third great change, they move into the town dumps, the sort of mess we make, and they exploit that. Then what do? That's not enough. They move onto our houses and start breeding on top of our houses. And the latest innovation of this extraordinary creature is snatching people's lunches in St. Stephen's Green. And now there is adaptation for you. Multiple. Now, what they'll do next is something of a mystery, but it's a great bird. It's a very successful entrepreneurial bird.
Well, speaking of snatching sandwiches, I don't know if you saw the news during the week in Hemley-on-Thames across the water that the red kites are now so numerous. They were extinct in Ireland for over 100 years, if I'm not mistaken, Niall, They were brought back. They were they were pretty much down to the last couple of pairs in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain, were they not?
They were hanging on in Wales. There was a good population in Wales. And they bounced back there. But what they did was in England and parts of Scotland, they reintroduced them, I believe, using Spanish birds to try and bolster that population. And it's done very well.
Well, they're now so numerous, they're as annoying now as gulls. They're in Hemley-on-Thames actually snatching sandwiches from people's hands. But back to the friendliness or tameness or the exploitation of the robin of humans. Aidan Ilana, what have you got to say?
Well, Derek, what I have to say is what are you like trying to feed a poor robin with a bun and a piece of coffee? Honest to God,
you
should have had mealworms. Mealworms are robin's favourite food, and if you want to emulate Niall Hatch and have a robin on your hand, you'll have to try it at home in your own garden. Get mealworms, put them out in your garden, and your local robin in the garden will become accustomed to them. And then as you appear then, because they really love mealworms, they'll want them, and then you put them on your hand eventually and hold it out, and you can train the robin in your garden to come to your hand and do it. But I mean, good off with a blueberry muffin down to Herbert Park and thinking that a random robin will come to your hand just like that is obviously that wasn't the thing. But did you ever see all the pigeons? They land on people's heads and things as well too, and it isn't even just birds, because you all talk about birds all the time. I mean, foxes now in Dublin City come up to people looking for food in their gardens, at the back gardens, up to the door, if people continue to put out food for the foxes. So these are all things that are associated with humans because of food. And then, of course, we have dolphins in the sea that come and play with people, and we don't even provide them with food, and yet they seem to be friendly to us or see us as a playmate. So it isn't just something that seems to me to be confined to birds. You know, other creatures will do it too, if, as Richard says, to see an advantage for themselves in it.
Derek, that robin that I took the photograph of was very interesting because it genuinely seemed to have no fear of me whatsoever, and it wasn't associating me with food. I didn't have any food. I didn't try to feed it. It just didn't seem to recognise a human as being a threat. Mm. But I stayed around it. Let me honestly get my phone within an inch of it. It looks like I zoomed in to take that photograph. I didn't. I held the camera lens right up in front of the bird. But then I noticed it started to sing from the bush when I was there beside it, so sort of maybe proclaiming me as part of its territory, I'd like to think. But then it started to feed on natural food. I could see it getting little spiders, and it was getting some seed from a feeder deer nearby, and I could see what it was doing. It was using me to scare away the other birds. So it had no competition from the blackbirds and the song thrushes and the wrens because they were frightened of me, but this robin wasn't. So I think that's what was going on.
Do you feel exploited now?
I feel privileged and honoured. I'm glad to be exploited.
Anyway, you can have a look at that picture right now by visiting our website. Jarlath has put it up there, rte.ie/Mooney. Let's say good evening to Terry Flanagan. Terry, where are you today?
Well, Derek, I'm back on the Dodder where I was last week, but not quite in the same spot. I'm closer up to Dartry than I was last week. I was down near Marion College. And I tell you this, when I was leaving last week after the programme, about 7 o'clock, we'd packed up here and we're heading back up along the river. It was a beautiful evening, very, very sunny, a bit like where it is now with Aina. It's not quite as nice today. It's a bit more overcast. But as we were walking back along the river, I couldn't help but noticing these massive swarms of small flying insects over the river. And it wasn't just me, there were lots of people there that were taking videos of them. So I took some video of it too and I put it up on Twitter. And believe it or not, I got a huge response. And it started a discussion as to what are they and what are they doing? Well, the answer is they're midges, or correctly called non-biting midges. And they were forming these tightly packed balls about 2 or 3 metres across. Now, you often find these in sunlit areas over a river. And as the sun moves across the sky, you'll actually see them, the ball of them moving across as well. I presume they're looking for the warmth of the sun. So what's happening? Nobody had a clue what was happening. Well, what's happening is they were all mating. That's what they were doing. And the massive groups, they were males. And the females, they don't swarm at all. But what they were doing is they were flying into the swarm looking for a mate. And then it's very hard to see because they move so fast. But you could see what looked like a pair dropping out of the ball down to the ground and then mating on the ground. And of course, all of the time, the males, they're competing for the best position in the swarm. And the males, they appeared, if you watch them closely, it looks like they're trying to dart backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, but trying to stay within the ball at all times. It's as if they were looking for the best position. Now, I was trying to figure out what would be the best position there. Would it be the edges or the centre or the top or the bottom? If they're at the edges, well, then maybe they could nab a female on the way in. But if that's the case, well, maybe then they might get caught by a predator. Because remember, the reason why we were down here last week is we were looking at the wagtails and the way the wagtails could dart up in the air and catch these midges. So then we were thinking, why don't they bump into each other? They're extremely agile in flight. And in fact, one or two people mentioned the idea that they were very, very similar to the starling murmurations. Well, these insects, these gnats or midges, they belong to an order of insects called the Diptera. And Diptera means just two wings or one pair of wings. When we think of insects, and if we were going to classify insects, we would say that they have a head, a thorax and an abdomen, and three pairs of legs and two pairs of wings. Now, in the case of these flies here, what they've done is they've lost one pair of wings and they've replaced them with a set of what are called haltiers. And these haltiers give them great stability. Now, getting back to the big masses or the swarms of them here, these flies here, they don't live very long. They only live for a couple of weeks as adults, and they don't feed as adults either. So the females, she drops her eggs into the water or onto the vegetation along the water's edge. So the eggs, they hatch, they develop into larvae, which pupate, which then form more adults, and we get the next swarm. And we can get lots of swarms throughout the summer. And these swarms, they can be huge. In fact, so many midges once swarmed on Salisbury Cathedral that the fire brigade was called out. It looked as if the spire was on fire, smoke coming out of the top of it. But remember this, most of these, they don't make it because these provide food for the likes of fish and dragonfly and water beetles. And what you have to remember is that the insects, these are the most successful group of animals on Earth. Now, you might say, how do we define success? People might look at Derek Mooney and say, there's a very successful man.
I doubt
look
it.
At him. No, he's got a big job in RTE.
Has
and
been.
He drives has a big car and he's got a big house.
It's old.
But let me tell you, here's poor Terry Flanagan, a humble school teacher, but I'm actually more successful than you. And not only that, Richard and Aina are even more successful than I am. And why is it? Well, it's all down to the amount of babies that you leave behind. And the insects, well, they are fantastic at it. It's estimated that for every human on Earth, there are 1.4 billion insects. get that, 1.4 billion insects for every human on Earth. So, what are these little buggers doing here on a Sunday afternoon? All they're doing is they're maintaining that success rate and making sure that there'll be plenty of them for next year and the year after and the year after and the year after. So that's what I'm at here this afternoon. I'm watching the midges.
Well, Terry, we might come back to you later on because I know where you are there are sequoia trees. Isn't that how you pronounce it? Sequoia?
Sequoia, yes.
The redwoods that they have in California, the giant redwoods, and I have a couple of questions about that. Terry, for the moment, thank you very much indeed. I have to say, I don't judge a person's success on the basis of the number of children they produce, the number of offspring. I have to say, well, Richard, you probably would you, Richard Collins?
Well, now, there's quality and there's quantity, Derek, you know. You might hit the jackpot. There's two approaches to breeding. One is to have multiple offspring, a huge number, on the basis that most of them will come to grief, but the odd one will succeed and your genes will be carried on to future generations. Mm-hmm. The other approach, the K strategies, it's called, there's an equation with K and R in it. R is the strategy where you spread your bread upon the waters and get as many partners as possible. The K strategy says, oh, I'll just have a few, but I'll mind them, I'll send them to ballet classes and elocutions, and I'll sign them up for the most expensive schools, and I'll do everything to protect them on the basis that they have a much better chance in life. So there are these two extreme strategies, do you see? So Derek, I don't know, but your lifestyle, Derek, is a mystery to me.
It's not a mystery to the public.
You may have. There may be thousands
you're obviously
of
reading
young
the wrong news
moonies out there. For all I know, you well, never know, you see. So I mean, the two strategies in nature. I mean, look, frog will produce 2,000 eggs in a sitting or something like that. Salmon, vast numbers. The giant puffball, 10 million spores out there, do you see? Harbor porpoise, about four in the course of its life. So they're the two extreme strategies. Which one is best?
Who knows?
Neither.
I bet you Aina knows. Aina, you've got a view.
Survived.
Aina.
Of course I have a view. I always have a view. I mean, if you have children, you are immortal. You've sent on your genes. They've gone on, regardless of whether you have millions of children or just a few. If they survive for the next, I mean, my lot now have gone on to grandchildren. So my genes have gone two generations. I'm not in charge anymore after that. I don't know what my grandchildren will do. And the other way to be immortal, Derek, is to write a book, because then your words will survive after you. Now, not make radio programmes or not do appear on television or not do things that can be wiped or technology will fail, but write a book. I mean, something like the Book of Kells, which is probably the guts of 1,000 years old, is still around. So if you want to be immortal, and that's presumably a great way of being successful,
no,
if you go on forever, well, then that's what you do. Otherwise, you just have to live in the memory of people who loved you in the first place. And that's all right, too, to think that people will think fondly after you of you afterwards when you're long since gone. So there you have it. So to be successful, you have to be immortal.
No, to be successful, you have to survive. I'm 54. I've managed to get this far.
Email mooney@rte.ie. Take a look at our website, rte.ie/mooney.
You can send a text message about anything at all to 51551 or visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Now, the global call to clean our oceans continues to gather momentum, and it is one which we have explored on this programme many times in the past, like our Bergen Whale documentary, which looked at how a Cuvier's beaked whale washed up in Norway with a huge number of plastic bags in its stomach. Here, Helge Sufteland, a producer with NRK, the Norwegian national broadcaster, recounts the whale's final hours.
It came here and it came into a small little beach just outside Bergen, and very publicly was put down with a rifle in front of a lot of people. And as soon as we opened it, we saw that we had murdered it with plastic. It was so full in its stomach that it had just choked on plastic. And there's no way around this. We killed this poor creature. Magnificent sea creature that should be there to sort of remind us of the excellence of nature, and now had to be put down, go outside an oil refinery, funnily enough. This, of course, caused an outcry, not only in Norway, but in the world, as the media attention would show later.
That clip offered a stark reminder of the importance of protecting our seas. Next Tuesday, June 8th, is World Oceans Day, and NUI Galway have outlined a range of steps we can take to protect the largest connected ecosystem on Earth, and where they can enhance our overall well-being, including how healthcare professionals could consider blue prescriptions. That's nature-based interventions in, on or near water. To tell us more about it, we're joined now by Dr. Eiske Britton, co-author of the paper and a member of the Whittaker Institute at NUI Galway. She's currently based in Westport in County Mayo, from where she joins us now. Hello, Eiske. Tell us more about your work, please.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm one of the authors in a recent paper and part of the SOFI research project, which stands for Seas, Oceans and Public Health in Europe. And the paper kind of calls on the UN Ocean Decade to act as a meaningful catalyst for global change and reminding people of the critical, important link between the health of our ocean and human health.
What's wrong with our oceans?
Where to start? I think kind of at the core of my work as a marine social scientist is about understanding people first and our relationship with the ocean, because that's really kind of the root of the cause. And what I'm really most interested in is understanding how much the ocean kind of supports our health and well-being, how much we can benefit from healthy seas, and then also the impact when it's not cared for and we don't protect it. And I think like right now with climate action on the rise, which is fantastic, it's just really important to remember that ocean action is also climate action, because the ocean acts as our life support system. And unfortunately, it's not in great shapes.
Are you saying we've neglected our oceans?
Yeah, I mean, big time. The ocean plays such a critical role. It's buffering us from the worst effects of climate change, absorbing most of the excess heat, a lot of the carbon dioxide, and that's having knock-on consequences, not to mention just the increasing levels of pollution. So kind of everything we use and consume in our day-to-day lives, all the waste products from that end up ultimately in our waterways and in the ocean. So it's accumulating a lot of, well, a lot of our waste. And then also the impact on how we fish. And I think a lot of it is to do with a disconnect, the ocean feeling kind of out of mind, out of sight for so many people. And what I'm excited about is that there seems to be a shift in a movement, in particular in Ireland, of people really reconnecting with the ocean, our seas and coasts, and in particular recognizing just how important it is for our health and well-being, even as a place to go for respite, solace, to soothe our very frayed nervous systems.
I'm surprised you say there's a disconnect between Irish people and the ocean, given that we're not landlocked here, we're surrounded by water.
Well, you would think so, because we've one of the largest, most biodiverse maritime territories. We're definitely more blue than green, I like to think, in terms of the water and ocean space we have. But unfortunately, we're also really lagging behind in global targets for things like ocean conservation, in particular the 30 by 30, which is to protect 30% of our global oceans by 2030. And in Ireland, in terms of protected areas, we kind of come in around 2 or 3% at the moment. And no area is sort of fully protected. So we've got a lot of kind of catching up to do, but there's a huge opportunity there to engage people in this really meaningful participation around a vision for healthy seas and oceans in Ireland. And so currently there's a public consultation on a new marine protected area bill. So I definitely invite anyone listening who's interested to really have your say. I know the Irish Wildlife Trust have great resources on how to do that. And there's a narrative that's changing definitely in the likes of, we've got the Oceans of Learning podcast that the Marine Institute have just put out. So again, is celebrating these stories of the sea and our human connection to it.
Richard.
Eiske, I always think that the sea, after all, is our cradle of life. That's where we come from. And in fact, in a way, we are semi-marine species, it always seems to me. Now, Derek mentioned that Ireland should be a great maritime nation. But the record isn't really great. If you look northwards to Norway, look at the enormous fleets of ships that Norwegians have. Go south to Portugal, where Henry the Navigator had his school and the Spanish. These countries are great maritime countries, but the Irish, oddly enough, have been very shy about the sea. The sociology of Ireland and the sea, it seems to me, is very interesting. Why are we so bad when it comes to the marine?
Yeah, it's the ultimate question, isn't it? I think in Ireland it is surprising as an island nation that we don't have as deep a connection in some ways. But then I also think when we think about things like the environment, environmental protection, the world over, we're still very land-centric. We tend to just think from a land-based perspective. And I think in Ireland it wasn't perhaps always the case that we weren't as, you know, that we were as disconnected as we are now, perhaps. And so I think it's really, it is changing. And as you rightly say, there's that, you know, there's that deep emotional cultural connection, and also the fact that we are ocean. You know, our bodies are something like 60% salt water. Every second breath we take is coming from oxygen produced from the ocean. So there are, you know, lots of ways to kind of tap into that connection. For us in Ireland in particular, and also globally, it's not just I think when we talk about the ocean, it isn't just a marine issue for marine experts and marine sectors. And it's just as much about how we want to thrive as a community, because the ocean in some way or form touches every part of our life. And it's about what matters most for our health. And I think taking pride in our maritime identity and celebrating how much the ocean does for us would be a really great place to start. And I think this week is going to be a fantastic opportunity for that, with World Oceans Day on June 8th. And, you know, even in the last handful of years, I'm seeing so many more events in Ireland celebrating our connection to the sea again.
You were a very brave lady to take up arms against a sea of troubles, as Hamlet said, because the sea of troubles is enormous. The range of problems facing the sea is gigantic. Everything from the rise in temperatures and deoxygenation, acidification, algal blooms, overfishing, noise upsetting species. Are you going to wage war on all fronts, or do you recommend choosing one or two more attainable objectives? Are there more attainable objectives that you can choose? Or is there a salient central problem which should be addressed, leaving all others aside?
Yeah, the short answer is there are so many things you can do. I think at the core of it for me in my work is about how do we create a culture of care? So the sense of reciprocity, if we understand how much the ocean does for us and then feel empowered to do things in return for it. So I think it starts there. And for example, there's loads of ways and examples of like things to do for the sea in my new book called 50 Things to Do by the Sea. But it really gets at that more, how to engage in a more mindful way. And then there are other examples of just amazing initiatives happening. So in Ireland, too, there's also a shift towards recognizing the healing benefits of the sea through things like ocean therapy. So I'm seeing more and more of these kind of organizations and charities, especially around mental health, set up, because blue spaces, especially seas and coasts, are the most psychologically restorative of all environments for humans. And we've got really strong evidence to support that. And I think it's essential at this time, you know, of heightened psychological distress and trauma. And so we're seeing things like liquid therapy based in Donegal, working with youth as a way to kind of build confidence and connection to their own well-being through the sea. And also InclusSea is a European research project I'm a part of that's all about restoring the ocean as a healing and inclusive space for everyone. So it focuses on fostering best practices that promote greater accessibility and inclusion in surfing for people with physical disabilities. So that's a big part of my work as well. And then in terms of individual actions, there are really ways to kind of have your say now. So I mentioned the 30 by 30 petition. It's a global petition. We're seeking 1 million signatures to be delivered to the UN later this year. And then, you know, also getting involved. There's so many amazing ocean NGOs here in Ireland who also do a lot of amazing citizen science initiatives. So you can contribute to helping to better understand what's happening in our ocean. And then if you have a business, it'd be also amazing if you could do something like an ocean impact audit. So how is your business impacting or contributing to ocean health? That might seem like a strange thing to think about, but basically it means looking at things like, how are you managing your waste? Are you moving towards zero plastics? Because we know like plastic pollution is such a huge issue as well for the health of our ocean. And also, what's your carbon footprint? Because the ocean is so impacted by climate change, but it's also a key part of the solution. And there's a huge opportunities, I think, again, going back to creating that connection, things like team building through doing things like beach cleans and those citizen science initiatives.
You mentioned liquid therapy. Where is that taking place? And I know you're also a fan of health professionals writing more blue prescriptions.
They run their program actually in my local beach where I learned to surf, Rosnaila. And yeah, we're working at the moment in that larger project. Inclusi, they've programs running throughout the summer. The main program is called A Drop in the Ocean. So it just taps into all these ways to connect with the ocean to restore a sense of health and well-being through something like surfing. So it's just a wonderful way to engage with the ocean in a very positive way. Yeah, so my area of work for the last number of years has been looking at the restorative benefits of these kind of, I suppose, what's called social prescribing or nature prescribing. So activities that engage people in the outdoors for the benefit of health and well-being. And we know from research that doing these activities in, on or near water is incredibly beneficial for psychological well-being. It's something I also write about in my book. It speaks about things like, for example, blue mind. So it's the calming effect that we feel in our bodies. But what's actually happening when we're by water, even simply looking at it, it's altering, for example, our brain waves, putting us in a calmer state. So we're just better able to heal when we're by water or even in it. And it's an antidote to that kind of red mind stress response state that we're in increasingly too much of the time.
Well, Iski, thank you very much indeed. And we'll put more details about World Ocean Day and your paper on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. For the moment, Iski, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. Míle maith.
Míle maith. Aina, do you know anything about the algal blooms? Niall, do you know anything about them? We see on the news yesterday, Turkey was plagued by the largest outbreak of sea snot. They're calling it on record as mucus hit the Sea of Marmara coastline.
I did. It doesn't sound very pleasant at all. I certainly would not like to swim through that. And I tell you, fish wouldn't like to swim through that either. There can be a big problem in oceans. It seems to have been caused by an excess of what they're calling nutrients in the water. For nutrients, read sewage. And this promotes this algal bloom. And what that does is that deoxygenates the water. It's sliming up the coast and it could poison shellfish down to a depth of even 100 metres. So it's really bad.
Aina?
Hello, yes, indeed. I mean, it's grey sludge that forms when the algae are overloaded with the nutrients. So you have algae in the water all the time. I mean, this is what you have. It's part of the food chain. So if there's their plants, I mean, they grow from the nutrients in the water. I mean, we get these algal blooms even in Ireland when there's too much nitrates in the water. So in Turkey, they had the extra heat because it's much warmer there. So things grow faster in the heat. Extra nutrients, probably, as Niall says, from sewage and pollution. And as a consequence, then all of the oxygen is taken up because, you know, you think about algae, okay, they're plants, they give off oxygen, but not when the sun isn't shining. And at nighttime, they don't. They take in oxygen, they respire, and they cause the water to become deoxygenated. They break down, there are layers of snots up on the top of the ocean. They're stopping the light coming in then for other things down further, and they stop the fish having anything to eat and any oxygen to breathe through their gills. So it's a really bad scene. And again, caused by too much pollution in the water itself. So that's something that really ought to be, you know, coped with, because you can actually get nitrates and phosphates out of pollution, out of sewage by tertiary treatment. We have primary treatment, secondary treatment and tertiary treatment. And tertiary treatment, we have the technology for it. Some sewage systems are put through all three of them and they don't put in nitrates and phosphates. So it's not as if the technology isn't there to do it. It's again, like Whitney he was saying, we have to have the knowledge of it, we have to have the will to do it, and then we have to demand that this cleanness is put in place for us, even if it costs us more in our taxes. We have to see that it's worth doing. So sea snot in Turkey does not seem like a good thing. A staycation is definitely what I'm doing this year. Ain't going to Turkey to swim through the snots.
I don't blame you. Going back to what Isi was saying about the blue prescriptions, let's say hello now to Dr. Knut Moe, who's a South Dublin GP. Hello, Knut. Have you ever prescribed that people should take a kind of walk along the seaside or go out on a boat or go for a swim or anything like that? Have you written a blue prescription is what I'm asking you?
Absolutely, Derek. I think it's an increasingly common thing for GPs and healthcare professionals to prescribe exercise and getting out and about, particularly in these strange times that we've been having, where people are working from home and often cooped up indoors. So there's clear benefits for getting out, clearing the head, as mental health problems are much more of an issue. Getting out, there's a calming element to do with the water, whether it's the wind, the sea air, watching the world go by. It's something we all need to do a little bit more of and perhaps haven't had the chance to or have to be reminded to of late. So something we do as GPs quite a lot now is prescribe exercise as outdoors or fresh air, specifically blue prescriptions. It's something that's becoming a bit more common now, but it's something that needs to be done more to help with mental health, for sure.
But do you actually write it on a piece of paper?
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes you need that. I mean, if you find somebody who's coming in who maybe is, I think in a GP's office, part of what we say, about 50% of what we say doesn't get retained. So sometimes it's important to actually write down these things. It's not something that needs to be, you can say, just go out and make sure you walk for 30 minutes a day along the sea. It's great to clear the air. It's good for the lungs. You know, people would be extolling the virtues of sea air for years from a physical health point of view. But the mental health side of things, yeah, we would write it down in people maybe who need a little reminder and to be told it's okay to do this. You know, to take that time for yourself in an otherwise maybe hectic lifestyle, to find those moments of calm down by the sea or down by the water. We were out on a canal boat only this morning on the Royal Canal with friends of ours, and it's just a reminder to slow down. The kids loved it, and seeing the nature that was there and you know, the lily pads and everything was absolutely just the calm. It was just the perfect tonic on a day like today.
So you would say, yes, you're all for it.
100%. Yeah, absolutely.
Canute, thank you very much indeed. I'm just thinking, you know, the way you can never read a doctor's prescription. How would you understand what the guy was meaning at all?
Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031. Email mooney@rte.ie.
As always, we don't have enough time on this programme. It's only 54 minutes or thereabouts, but we have time for another item. And his name is Niall McCauley. Hello, Niall. Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, my name's Niall and I've got an Irish garden YouTube channel.
You have? I was watching you the other day. And you were talking about the no-mow lawn. And I'm very interested in this because I tried this in my own home when I moved in first. I decided that in the back garden, I was never going to cut the grass. I was going to let it go wild. But it got to a point where I couldn't get into the back garden. It was a disaster. It was overgrown. It was overgrown into the gardens on either side. But as I've been walking around a lot lately and going into various parks in Dublin City, I noticed that they're all leaving these wild spaces, but little paths through them. So then I thought, fantastic. So I was looking it up and then I came across the No Mow Lawn and your YouTube channel. So tell us about the No Mow Lawn. People can enjoy their hobby of cutting the grass, but they can make space for biodiversity. Go ahead.
100%. Yeah, because I was in exactly the same position as yourself. We moved into our house about 18 months ago because we'd fallen in love with the garden, but it's a big garden. It's about an acre. We are in County Meath.
Okay.
So the garden is really pretty large. It has a lot of grass, and I'm ashamed to say I'm a bit of a bad gardener. I hate cutting grass.
Me too.
So decided that I would leave the entire back garden to go to no mow. Now, that's about 2/3 of an acre. And it's an absolutely fantastic thing to do. Just the increase in biodiversity, plant life, insect life, it just absolutely boomed in a matter of months. I had expected it might take a few years to get established, but it was absolutely brilliant.
So now what do you do? Where did you go wrong and where are you going right?
where I went wrong was not properly thinking about scale. I think I had ideas beyond my means and let so much go that when I tried to rein it back in, it was really pretty difficult. So this year, what I'm doing is I'm choosing just small sections rather than going for the whole thing.
So you're leaving a path through your wild garden.
Yeah,
as absolutely. We're seeing in local parks, wherever you live, all around the country, this is kind of policy now. It's part of the pollinator plan, is it not, Niall?
It is. It's very important for promoting the insects, the birds, the small mammals, everything, because the whole ecosystem gets restored. And I think if we all did this in our gardens, I mean, there's 1.5 million private gardens in Ireland. So taken as a block, it's one of the most important habitat types that we have. And it's one that we can all control. So if even 10% of the people in Ireland were to do this, it would make a huge difference.
So let's say we cut the little path and we leave the rest wild, but do we still have to manage the bit that's wild?
There's not an awful lot of management to do at the very start, so you get to take a nice break through the spring and the summer and you can chill out for a while. The one thing you need to remember, though, is once you get towards the late summer, you are going to have to start to rein it back in. You're going to need to cut it down. But that's not just like taking your lawnmower to it and cutting it in one. Because all of the grasses and the plants have grown quite tall, what you essentially need to do is scythe it down, shorten it down in height initially, and then you can start bringing it back down towards something more like a lawn. So it means really using something like a strimmer instead.
Now, what about diversity of plants in that wild space?
So it's going to depend on where you are and what grass you're letting grow. I was absolutely astounded by what I got within a couple of months. I'm fortunate I live out in the country and the garden used to be a field. So there's probably a lot of stuff sitting latent there. But certainly, you know, last year, within a matter of months, we had buttercups, self-heal. We had some oxeye daisies, which I was absolutely delighted about. I thought I was going to have to wait years before I would get something like that. I was way more excited than I should have been. Stitchworts, plantain, clover, just the diversity is incredible. And as soon as you have that plant diversity, the wildlife will come.
Okay. Now, did you plant any seeds yourself?
No, it was entirely
completely natural.
Purely
just
by
came back.
Not itself. Mowing.
Same with my own. Ain't any Lana.
Yes, indeed. This is true because in our soils, there is an enormous reserve of seeds of plants that don't get a chance to grow because of the bullying effect of the grass. Grass is a great nutrient demander and people are always feeding their lawns and mowing their lawns and cutting the heads of anything else that dares stick up its head. But there are a huge amount of seeds in lawns, in fact, or in the soil in your garden. And this is what he was looking at, Niall was looking at when he didn't mow. He wasn't cutting the heads off things, so his oxeye daisies grew, his self-heal grew, things like stitchwort, ribwort, all of these things came up and were flowering then, buttercups, all of the things that you would cut the heads off, because the only things that grow with their heads cut off are grass, because it grows from the bottom, and rosette plants like, say, dandelions and daisies. If you want to have dandelions and daisies in your lawn, keep mowing it because you cut away everything else. But that all is just, as it were, laissez-faire, doing nothing. Now, when he cuts it at the end of the summer with his scythe or his trimmer, the really good thing to do is leave the cuttings there for a day or two until the seeds are kept there, because if you just cut it and take it away at once, the dead heads and the seeds will be taken away too. So you want to leave it there for a day or two before you gather it up and take it away like hay. But there's another thing you can do altogether, which is quite different, and that's to grow an OMO lawn, if you like, by planting, by cultivating it, getting rid of the whatever you have there, and planting things like saxifrage, planting things like clovers, things that aren't grass, things that aren't going to grow, and you're going to have to mow them. So you have this low sort of plant life growing there that doesn't grow into grass at all. I mean, have no grass, have it fairly poor. Things like clover make their own nutrients because they're legumes. They can take nitrogen from the air. They don't need to be on rich soil. So if you really want no trouble and a lovely thing, take away your whole sod and make your soil poor and plant these kind of lawns. You see recipes or ingredients or whatever you might like for them on flat roofs, and people that have lawns on their roofs, obviously you can't get up there to mow it. So they have things that will put up with dryness. They will things that don't grow very high. Things like, you know, sort of nearly in the cactus family, saxifrages and things like that are going to have fairly thick leaves that will hold on to moisture. So you can have a different, a complete chamomile is another one that you can grow in those kind of situations. When you haven't got grass at all, it doesn't grow tall and it has lovely flowers in it. So having an OMO lawn can be just stay with what you have and see what comes up, or put in a whole new lot with different flowers entirely and see how that works. It's a great idea and really good for biodiversity. So well done, Niall, for having a go at it yourself.
Indeed, well done. Your YouTube channel is fantastic. So just tell people where they can find you.
Absolutely. Go to YouTube and my channel is Niall Gardens, and it's basically me and my garden, or at least it's me in my garden,
me
what I'm doing.
And my garden, Nile Gardens.
Yeah, absolutely.
On YouTube, and yep. It's free to watch.
It is indeed.
It is indeed. Well, what's the plan? I mean, why are you doing it free? Eventually going to start charging people?
Well, I wish I could, actually. It's more because I took on this huge garden, and it's great, actually, to be able to share it with people,
yeah.
Especially over the last year where we've all been in our own homes.
Absolutely.
It's been really lovely to be able to put it out there.
Well, it's very timely. And thanks for making the journey down today for such a short
amount. Oh, you're welcome.
Not at all. I really do appreciate it. You'll find the details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney.